9 a.m., Little Rock, Arkansas. We're on KABF FM 88.3, www.kabf.org. 100,000 watts of people power broadcasting throughout Arkansas from Little Rock, as well as live streaming and podcast that you can pick up at www.kabf.org starting probably Tuesday of next week. At Wade's World, we talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Darcy Pumphrey, who's written a very interesting study of the Wilbur Mills Expressway, as I call it. There are other names, but we won't go all the way there. Darcy, we're talking to you in Utah, right? Welcome to Wade's World.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we got you up a little earlier, but it's all good. And Darcy was just telling me that you're now working at Utah State.
Yes, I'm at Utah State University. I work in the library here on campus, and I am the digital library coordinator. So I deal with archival material to digitize it and make exhibits online.
Fantastic. So you're from Arkansas?
Yes, I am. I lived in Arkansas all my life until 2011 when we moved to Utah.
Well, I never knew. I just have it in queue.
There you go. And Wilbur Mills, how did you get involved in looking deeply at the Wilbur Mills Expressway?
I grew up in Little Rock. I was born in 1982, and I-630 was officially opened in 1985. So I've really only known a Little Rock with, and I call it 630. but I lived in West Little Rock, and I went to junior high at Dunbar and high school at Central. So almost every day of the week, 630 was part of my life.
I bet it was.
Yes. and as a child, I recall just looking out the window and the car and wondering why they built these neighborhood roads on either side of 630 to just kind of end right there at the chain link fence. It didn't really make sense to me. Of course, but as I got older, I realized that these streets were once connected and the interstate was what had severed them.
Or as we would say, as you got older, you realized it never made any sense.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I thought about the houses that were once in that location that now I was flying over at 60-plus miles per hour, which is probably a little bit faster when I was in high school trying to get to school. That this area was once a connected neighborhood and had a sense of community in the interstate split that. So a question that always seemed to be on the back of my mind was, did the people that lived in these homes resist the project and the taking of their homes, and what was that process like? So then fast forward to graduate school, I entered the public history program at UALR and started to think about my thesis topic. I was driving home from class one night from the UALR campus over to Hillcrest, where I lived at the time. When I drove over, it's the Jonesboro Drive Bridge that's kind of right there by the old location now of Ray Wunderfield. It was still standing at the time. And as I was looking at Ray Wunderfield and thinking about how the interstate just skimmed the boundaries of that baseball field, the thoughts I had as growing up in Little Rock kind of came back, and I began to wonder again about the planning for 630. Did anyone fight it? Why was it built where it was built? What was the city like before 630 and how the interstate had changed it? So I had a lot of questions, and I knew some aspect of that story of 630 would be my thesis topic, but of course I needed to narrow it down. So I started doing research, and I couldn't find really a comprehensive story about the beginnings of 630, its planning and construction. And when I discovered the involvement of Acorn and the lawsuits, I knew that was the story I wanted to tell.
Well, and recently we've had, some Jack Levy, who was, and we'll talk about this, the attorney on the suit filed around violations of the Environmental Protection Act in the Wilbur Mills, just recently passed away within the last 6 weeks. And Alana Hange, who was one of the great Acorn leaders in the MacArthur Park area, whose house ended up being relocated as part of the settlement, also just passed away within 10 days, 2 weeks of when Jack passed away. So.
Wow.
Much on our minds, and there's going to be some news about the Wilbur Mills Expressway. So what may seem to be a story 30 years gone is actually more contemporary than we think. So you started digging into it and wondering how this thing all evolved. Looking at your paper, this is a 50-60-year project, wasn't it?
Yes, it took a long time. And actually, Little Rock kind of had on the in their plans in the 30s and 40s some type of east-west thoroughfare. And really, in 1958 was when they got some funding, the city got funding to start building this east-west thoroughfare that wasn't a part of the interstate highway system at that time.
56 years ago.
Yes. And it took 27 years, really, if you start from the 58 date until when it officially opened in 1985. So 27 years to build 7.4 miles. But yeah.
Well, and when did they finally start breaking ground? I mean, let's walk us through. So when they first got the idea and started trying to promote this, were the reasons the same in 58 as they evolved by the time 85 came along?
Yeah, well, there wasn't really a main kind of east-west thoroughfare in that part of town, and so I think that was kind of why it was on the plans. In 58, there was a bond passed, and so the city got money to purchase right-of-way and start the project, but then they realized that they really didn't have all the funds they needed to undertake such a massive project, so they went to the state highway department, and they agreed to assist with the funding. But then it wasn't the state's priority to get it finished, so they just kind of had this road, partial massive road there in the middle of the city.
Who was promoting it back at that point?
The mayors were pushing it, and I believe the business, downtown businesses, and there was a lot of talk about it revitalizing downtown, which, of course, we've seen that it kind of did the opposite, and it moved a lot of the businesses out to West Little Rock.
Well, you might wonder in retrospect whether or not that was always the plan. I mean,
yeah.
Part of, and perhaps this isn't as accurate a historical ending as you found, but it always seemed the main proponents of a East-West Expressway were real estate interests.
Mm-hmm. And then,
partly because they wanted to develop, suburban communities with access to cheaper land farther west. They wanted an expressway. I don't know that there was ever anything more than the most tenuous arguments for how this would help anything downtown Little Rock other than getting commuters into downtown Little Rock.
Definitely. And in my research, I never could find something where someone actually stated that. Everything was about, it will revitalize downtown. But, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, no, that's not what it's doing. And I saw that we moved to West Little Rock in 1989, so I grew up out there in St. Charles. And I remember when I was young and we would drive out there and Chenal Parkway was just trees. That's all it was to get out to our neighborhood, and our neighborhood was on the edge of the city. And now I feel like it's almost midtown now, and of course Chenal Parkway is just full of retail buildings.
Well, and I could share that as well. The tower for KBF was the first tower built on Chenal Mountain out there. It was, that was high ground. We were the first tower, and it was a long way from downtown Little Rock, but that obviously, for a 100,000-watt station, that gave us a place to do the signal. But, we were 20 miles out of town. Now, you drive out there, you go through, what used to be Pankey, an African-American neighborhood. You go through one, McMansion, development after another, like you say, down to Chenal Parkway. And there's a whole tower farm now, on the mountain overlooking the suburbs, but it used to be nothing was out there at all.
Very true, very true.
So then they got this notion. It was promoted by the mayor, and the state had to bail them out, eh?
They did, but the state really didn't. The state had other projects within the state. There was a quote, one of the directors of the Arkansas Highway Department said, we have people out in the state in the mud and the dirt in their roads, so why should we focus on this project in Little Rock right now? We'll finish it, but it's not our priority. So then leaders, politicians started to look at maybe they could get to be part of the interstate highway system. And then they would receive 90% federal funding for the construction of the interstate and 10% of the funding would be the state's responsibility, and the state highway department said, okay, we can handle that if it gets included in the interstate highway system. So I believe that was March 1970 that they made the request to be included, and Wilbur Mills was very supportive of this idea, and of course he was a very influential U.S. representative at the time.
The House Ways and Means Committee. So
yes, he was. So
his hands on the purse strings then. So
he did.
He was at the sort of zenith of his power around 1970.
In my research, I couldn't really find any correspondence that he had had with the administration of the federal highway system, but I assume that it was more like conversations. But if anybody...
They weren't put it down in writing kind of people at those times.
Yeah, because I looked at the Mills collection up at Hendricks College, and very disappointing. I couldn't find anything really on 630 of any use except for some kind of promotional photos opening different miles of 630, which is not helpful for what I was looking for. But if anyone does happen to find documentation, I'd love to read about it. But so this request was initially denied, and what they had requested was they hadn't quite used up all their mileage allotment for the interstate highway system. They had like 3.4 miles left that they could apply. And they realized that there were some other states that were in a similar situation, so they wanted to see if they could just pull those few miles off of some other states and apply it to this Interstate 630. I guess between March and June, that was kind of worked out. In June, Little Rock received the mileage for Interstate 630. And so then they got started in earnest with it. One of the first projects that they needed to do was complete an environmental impact statement, because the recent National Environmental Policy Act had been passed. So that was a new requirement for highway departments to complete at the time. There weren't very many good guidelines about how to complete this, and the project was already underway. So they're kind of starting at the midway point here.
Now, how much of the project had been really started by that point? We're talking about early 1970 at this time, right?
Yeah, they had cleared the right-of-way. I know that. And I think that...
You mean they'd acquired most of the property?
Not downtown,
right.
But still kind of more out west.
The western side.
Yes, because that was easier because it was rural at that time. And then in 1969, they had completed Pine Street to Rice Street. So just kind of 1 mile there of road.
Out in the middle of nowhere, right?
Yeah, just the world's shortest interstate or highway at that point.
Well, and the context is also worth noting. It was in early 1970s also when you started hearing problems in other cities. So. Certainly New York under Robert Moses had been a great highway developer, and there was a huge fight along the West Side Highway in New York and whether or not to build it. There were fights that were breaking out in New Orleans about whether or not to build a huge expressway that would go along the river and go through the French Quarter, which is obviously a historic area. And there was the big Overton Park fight in Memphis, which was...
Yes.
Only hours away. So these just, put us in the context. And we're talking today to Darcy Pumphrey, who wrote a fascinating study called Too Little, Too Late, Why Little Rock's Freeway Resistance Movement Failed to Stop the Construction of Interstate 630. And in the process, working with the Public History Department out at UALR, has gotten really deeply involved in looking at the history of I-630, or the Wilbur Mills Expressway, as some of us call it. And we're talking about that today on Wade's World. So we had a lot of highway fights. There was a reevaluation of whether or not highway construction really was good for cities around that same time, wasn't there?
Correct, yes. And so there were all these freeway resistance movements popping up across the country. Another one was in Baltimore with I-70 and Lincoln Park. And it just, I visited there, interstate highway tourism, I guess, I don't know. the interstate just ends at a parking lot, and then there's a trail going off of it in a park, and they have a little wayside exhibit there that tells about the fight to stop it from going through the park.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. My friend that lives in Baltimore just got a kick out of, like, she asked me what I wanted to see in Baltimore, and I was like, can we go see the end of I-70? Because I've been reading about it.
There isn't a plaque, but there's a similar thing in San Francisco. Obviously, San Francisco is another one of those cities where all of a sudden the interstate ends and you go on, cross-town streets throughout the city until you get to, the Golden Gate Bridge. And, boy, that's made a difference in places like that. But so ACORN wasn't founded until June 18th of 1970. So obviously it could not have been involved in anything dating before that period because there was no ACORN at that time.
Yes.
As they then started getting approval for the interstate highway, what happened next year?
Well, the highway department created the environmental impact statement. That first one, I think it was about 10 pages long. Just kind of skimmed the topic, it seems like. Didn't really look at alternative routes. And so ACORN decided to challenge it in court, and that first lawsuit was filed in 1973, and the late Jack Levy was serving as the attorney pro bono for ACORN. And then the result of that first lawsuit was the judge, Judge Henley, ruled that first environmental impact statement was inadequate and told the highway department they would need to create a new one, which meant they would have to do more public hearings and studies, and that would open up more opportunity for citizens to question the project and the downtown portion. He also ruled that the construction of the downtown portion should be halted while this second environmental impact statement was created.
The first statement was, what had happened is ACORN in 1972, after being founded, as I said, in June of 1970, started a campaign called the Save the City campaign, in which it began systematically organizing in communities, Woodrow to Pine, the Centennial area, which is near Central High School, and other group, Oak Forest, which is right on the border of University Avenue. So as ACORN simultaneously began these half-dozen different neighborhood organizing drives, particularly in the downtown area, it started hearing huge complaints about what the impact of the Wilbur Mills Expressway might be. And that's, what moved its members to start getting involved. Looking at that 10-page statement, one of the things that they didn't even consider was not to build it at all. So it was one of those environmental impact statements that presumed the conclusion was, regardless of what happened in the environment, we have to build it. Even though the EPA requirements were, as you say, very new at that time, there was some settled views that you had to at least consider that the impact might be so adverse as not to require construction or not to allow construction unless either drastically remediated or not built at all, which is, clearly what happened in certain cities.
Yeah.
So then you have all this stuff. So the Judge Henley then ruled they had to go back to the well and actually do the real work finally. And then what happened?
So then they created that second environmental impact statement. There were challenges on it as far as, ACORN did a second lawsuit against it. Unfortunately, that one did not play out in ACORN's favor, and the highway department was able to move forward with construction. But during that time that the second environmental impact statement was being created, the Arkansas Historic Preservation Program was working with MacArthur Park neighborhood to create the MacArthur Park Historic District. They had it nominated to the National Register of Historic Places. Of course, it was just about to be plowed through, but they documented the historic district. And then also they worked out because of that historic district nomination, they now needed to work out a memorandum of agreement of mitigation measures. And so I think that was mostly Quapaw Quarter Association and the Historic Preservation Program that worked with the Highway Department to get a list of mitigation measures. I believe that was with the depressed roadway downtown. They also just things like the light fixtures, what infill would be in place kind of right along the interstate, what type of landscaping, even the paint color of the bridge, the bridges there, just to kind of minimize the impact as much as you can of a huge concrete path going through the middle of the neighborhood.
And it was interesting to read your paper about the role of Ann Barclay at that time. Tell us who she was, for those people who don't know, listening to Wade's World, and how that all worked out.
Okay, Ann Barclay, gosh. She was the head of the Arkansas Historic Preservation Program at the time. And so she was working out the negotiations of the Memorandum of Agreement, and she... a lot of the people that were opposed to 630 just said, well, why don't you just refuse to sign it? And she said, you know, if I refuse to sign it, they'll just override my signature anyway, and they'll move forward with it. So she signed it.
So Ann Bartley was the stepdaughter of former Governor Winthrop Rockefeller, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And so was appointed by, you know, Governor Bumpers at the time to the historical preservation, you know, whatever the position was.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways had been very supportive of the original campaign and lawsuit against the Wilbur Mills Expressway. I don't know if that came out in your research or not. So
it did not, no.
So she was sort of a behind-the-scenes supporter that was critical in many ways to a lot of that work. In fact, she brought up the lawyers who fought the New Orleans Expressway to Little Rock to visit. I know she had me meet with them, and then she ended up signing a critical document to allow it to go forward then.
Yes, she did. I think she just saw it as there was no choice. They were going to override her anyway.
And was that controversial, or did that end up being, because that happened actually 78 or so, right? Or?
Yeah, that was the time period for that. And I think there were some members of the Quapaw Quarter Association that were frustrated with it because she signed it initially, and they didn't realize that it was being signed, and they thought they were going to be able to have some input. Once that was realized, the Highway Department kind of went back and said, okay, well, let's document what mitigation measures the Quapaw Quarter Association wants.
And you mentioned, I think, Paul Kelly was part of that, who was a former city director in Little Rock, right?
Oh, okay. I don't recall that name, actually. There are a lot of names.
Well, it's in your paper.
Okay.
Now I finally am more of an authority on your paper than you are. So I was hoping this moment. We didn't plan this, listeners. But Paul Kelly is also a member of the KBF Board of Directors, the Arkansas Broadcast Foundation, and as one of the two DJs on our world music show every weekend. So. And a former, so clearly I recognize his name for a whole lot of reasons. One, I've known Paul back to the 70s, but also he continues to be involved in these things. I actually, after reading your paper, kidded him at Fordney a month ago about, hey, you know, and he said, you know, you forget how much, how many of those kinds of things y'all got me involved in. But, so they had to finally document all that stuff.
Yeah. They did. And so then they eventually did. They signed it and moved forward with the project. But I think it's good that the interstate is at least depressed, because at one point they were talking about, or at least in the downtown area, they were talking about putting it on elevated piers. I think that would just have been a complete disaster instead of what
There's
it is.
There's still an argument in New Orleans on the places where the interstate went over Claiborne Avenue, which used to be the historic center of the business district in the African-American parts of New Orleans. And, you know, it's an elevated thing, so it's dark all the time. I mean, this has happened in city after city. You can just imagine what that might have been like. And for all the sound barriers that are now built, because we didn't invent as many of those back then, but they're now very common, having a depressed success rate makes a huge difference.
Yes.
So one of the key things your paper points out, obviously, and you know, painful but true, is that the campaign to resist the fresh reconstruction partly wasn't successful because it just didn't start in time.
Yes, exactly.
So although it's easy for me to say why it didn't start in time, clearly it would have been nice if people were on it, you know, from Jump Street. Acorn got involved as soon as it could, but it's too little too late. I don't know if you've heard this, and so obviously past the scope of your paper, but recently the Arkansas Highway Department indicated it wanted to spend $500,000 to look at how to expand the Wilbur Mills Expressway I-630.
That's curious. I wonder what they're wanting to expand with it.
Well, I would imagine more lanes. I mean, of course, one of the immediate comments I got was, well, what would the impact be on things like the new Hillary Clinton Library, which abuts the expressway down in the Pine Woodrow area, all the development on South Main.
It's working.
So either... And at the same time, I mean, from the original environmental impact statements, the whole projection was only that it would save 3 to 5 minutes in commuting time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd think, I mean, expanding, what are we talking about? That it would save another 15 seconds someday?
Well,
I mean, there's not really that much traffic. I don't know what it was like in the 80s when you were driving it, but...
There seems to be kind of study after study, and I can't name any of them off the top of my head, but basically adding more lanes just adds more congestion. And so I think it wouldn't help resolve any of the issues that people see with the congestion of 630 and people in West Little Rock trying to get downtown in the morning and then back home in the evening.
Well, and it's so precious. I mean, because if we call that congestion... People really ought to visit some other cities.
True, very true. I mean, where I live now, the whole county where I live doesn't have an interstate, but it takes me like 5 minutes to get anywhere I need to go, and people complain about the traffic, and I'm like, well, it took me 6 minutes to get there instead of 5 minutes because, you know, I was backed up at one light, and they're wanting to do these projects to mitigate the congestion, and I'm like, this is nothing.
No, I mean, like I say, at rush hour a month ago, thinking about this, I actually retimed it at rush hour and off rush hour, and it still, from the whole course of the 630 from front to back, takes, you know, 6-7 minutes. I mean, mm-hmm. you can't beat how quick it is, and, you know, most people in Little Rock, I mean, you wait 15 minutes and rush hour's over. I mean, this is
exactly.
Not like New York City or Los Angeles or someplace like this. And almost every study I'm familiar with, as you know, it is one of those things, if you build it, people will go. I mean, if you build more expressway potential, it does make it more congested, not less, because it means more development in the sprawl, and there's every indication that this sort of, you know, Little Rock 20, 25 miles from downtown is not serving any of us.
Correct.
How could people get a copy of this paper if they were interested in digging deeper into all this with you, Darcy?
Okay, well, I have my thesis available online. I don't have the web address in front of me, but if you Google search Darcy Pumphrey, P-U-M-P-H-R-E-Y, and Interstate 630, the thesis is on my webpage at Utah State University, available for download.
You can also get it by, is it works.bpress.com/Darcy? Is that your internet? Yeah.
Yes, that's it. It's Bpress is the system that we use here at Utah State University to post our papers.
Okay, so if you wanted to look at the whole paper, it's works.bpress.com/Darcy_Pumphrey/1/, and you get right to... Darcy's page and how you can download a copy of this paper and read it all yourself. And we're also hoping that a revised version of it will be in Social Policy. I think you said it's going to be in the Arkansas Historical Review of some kind?
Yes, the Arkansas Historical Quarterly. I'm not sure what issue it's going to be in, but I know that it has been accepted for publication.
Darcy, thank you for being on Wade's World. This has been Wade Rathke with Darcy Pumphrey on a Interstate 630 in the Wilbur Mills and the fight to stop it and why we need to keep paying attention to this. This
thank
is Wade's World, www.kbf.org, 88.3 on your dial, 100,000 watts of people power. Next Friday, 9 a.m., we'll be back with Wade's World. Thank you.